Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your summer of so long to the crib and hello to the club. Music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. You may be wondering, who is that mellifluous vocalist sharing a heartfelt cover rendition of Radiohead's Creep? And of course, I say to you, who but Dave Chappelle? Dave Chappelle came out on stage at the Foo Fighters Madison Square Garden show. This was maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago. It was the first fully vaccinated, sold out event at the Garden in well over a year. Live music is back. Live music is back? Question mark. I want to talk about it. I want to talk about what the last 16 months have been like for the live music business. I want to talk about what the next few months are going to be like. Because I imagine if you are listening to podcast, you are the type of person who has perhaps already bought some tickets for some shows, or maybe even has already gone out to see some music or gone out to go dancing. And so I want to talk about what that has looked like and what it's going to look like. The person who has been paying attention consistently is Ben Cesario, the New York Times music business reporter. Hello, Ben.
Hello.
First of all, have you been to a show yet? We'll start digging in a minute, but tell me, have you been to a show yet?
I have not been to any indoor shows. I've seen like ad hoc outdoor kind of things, but I haven't really been to an official show yet.
Are you anticipating it? Are you dreading it? Like psychologically, are you ready for it?
That's an interesting question. I hunger for it. I miss it. I love it, but I'm also a little afraid. Like even though I'm vaccinated and even though I know most other people are, you know, it's been a year of a lot of anxiety. It's just kind of the whole idea of being there does kind of scare me a little bit.
Yeah. It's hard to shake off. So yeah. I definitely felt that. I definitely felt that at the Foo Fighters show, although something that pierced a hole in that balloon was there were a bunch of like anti-vax protesters or crisis actors. I couldn't really tell outside the venue. And I was like, okay, well, that's obviously ridiculous. So that made me feel a little bit better about going inside. But that said, someone in the row behind me was basically saying that they had used somebody else's vaccination certificate to get access to the venue. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, funny. So I feel what you're saying, but also I found that over the course of the evening and a few subsequent evenings since then at other shows, I'm feeling good. I'll talk about why a little bit more later. I think we should go back to March because in our universe, people were still putting albums out April, May, June. People were still making songs. People would go into studios. Taylor Swift, you know, went to the farm. Music was being made, but live music stopped cold. I wonder if you could explain the level of trauma that this event was for the live music business, for venues, and also for touring musicians.
It was heavy. And one thing to remember is just how fast it happened. If you remember, the virus was a subject of the news from late January, but it wasn't really until late February, early March that we started to see it on our shores and it became really a reality. And South by Southwest was canceled, Coachella was canceled, and then on March 12th, there was sort of a broad order across the country that touring shows were taken off the road. Broadway was essentially shut down because the governor gave an order shutting down any large events. All of that happened within a little over a week. So just the reality hit really hard. And the industry's like outward public posture about this was kind of like, hey, we're going to take a little pause here and, you know, we'll reassess in a few weeks and then hopefully get some shows back on. And there were still shows that were on sale, that were going on sale. But if you talk to people off the record and you talk to artist managers and booking agents and people, it was clear that this was a very, very serious problem. and that it was going to last for a pretty long time. Nobody really knew how long, of course, but I think there was a disparity between what was sort of being said publicly to reassure ticket buyers and what was being discussed privately in the industry.
We've talked, you and I, on podcast about the streaming economy and how rough that is as far as musicians making money off of their recordings, how hard it's become. I know there's no average, but for a reasonably well-known musician, someone with some songs on the radio, what percent of their income do you think comes from touring? Like, is it 50%, 80%, 30%? Like, where does it land? What's the range?
I think it's more in the 80% range.
That's nuts. That's nuts.
However, there are high costs that can come with touring. So, you know, how much does it actually end up being part of their pocket? I don't know the numbers, but it's well over 50. And I think that for even really well-known artists, even the really famous ones, it may be in the 75 to 80% range, because you have to imagine that even if you are Taylor Swift, sure, you're making money from your records, but you can make more money in one night playing a stadium show or playing an arena show than you can all year on streaming music, right? So there's just no comparison.
So this was an existential threat, like quite literally an existential threat to musicians of all levels. Obviously, we often think about how things like this affect smaller artists, independent artists, people who really do cobble together a working or middle class living based off of music. But this is an existential threat across the board.
It was an existential threat to those who couldn't make any kind of wage from streams of their music. But, you know, that 20% that's left over for Taylor or Drake or somebody, that's still pretty good. And, you know, it hurt them, of course, but you have to believe that Billie Eilish and whoever else, like, they had avenues to make money, even if they weren't on tour. So I think that level of just celebrity millionaire kind of people, I don't think they faced an existential threat. I think they faced a rough year. And I think if they were smart and if they had good management, they weathered it pretty easily. And maybe it was even an opportunity to sort of pause and make music like Taylor did.
As some people have said, a bandemic, not simply a pandemic, correct?
Right, right.
Okay, so first of all, if you're a multimillionaire, Ben Cesario is not weeping for you. Let's just make that clear. let's talk about the venues. These beautiful spaces all around the country that you and I love, and all of a sudden you cannot gather in these spaces. Can you talk a little bit about what was happening behind the scenes with venues and then the organizing that started to happen as it became clear that the circumstance was dire and long running?
That's where I think it did become more existential, because, you know, your average music venue really doesn't have anything to do other than to be a music venue. Most don't sell food. They can't really operate as takeout restaurants or something. There's no other business they can conduct. So there was real fear and terror that spread throughout that whole world, because a music venue can't really do anything other than to be a music venue. Most of them are not restaurants. They don't have any other business going on. They don't sell any other product other than tickets to go to a show. And so, especially for the smaller venues, the independently owned ones that were not owned by a big corporation, the possibility of losing their business, shutting down for good, was a real possibility. It's not super clear exactly how many have shut down. From the best I can tell, it's somewhere between 100 and 200 around the US, which is bad. But out of maybe 10, 20,000, it could have been a lot worse than it was. One reason is that they all hunkered down, they furloughed their staff, they cut their expenses down to as close to nothing as they could. They got some relief from the government. There were the PPP loans, there's this special emergency loan.
Well, I want to talk about that, because prior to this, prior to last March, how organized were small venues across the country? How much of a unified front did they present when it came to business concerns, when it came to advocacy work? Was it a well-organized set of people and institutions, or is it atomized and everybody's kind of following their own little wave?
It was totally separate and atomized. There was no union. There was no organization. I think these people would see each other at South by Southwest and whatever. But that was one interesting thing that came out of the pandemic was that the venues organized very quickly, the indie venues. They formed this trade group called the National Independent Venue Association. They hired big time lobbyists in Washington. They got to work. You know, one benefit that they have politically is that it's a local kind of business. So every local venue around the country has a representative in Congress. And those congressmen saw, and those senators saw that, like, these are local businesses that employ people. There's like the economic amplifier that they have where, like, if somebody goes to a show, they're going to go to a restaurant. They're going to take a taxi. They might have a hotel room. And they worked that hard. And it took a very long time, but Congress eventually did pass a big relief bill at the very end of the year. It was eventually $16 billion, which was supposed to be for independent venues, indie movie theaters, museums, performing arts centers, nonprofits. It was basically a sort of arts and culture venues bill. Finally got passed.
Bipartisan, correct.
It was bipartisan. It was by a very large margin. And it looked like a smashing success. And the idea there was it was the dead of winter. It was clear that nothing was going to be back on the road. There was not going to be any shows for many, many months. But that is when the vaccines arrived and Congress passes this bill. So there's like sort of promise for the near future. And the intention of this bill was to provide these venues and these arts organizations with enough cash to get through the next 6 months of operations to just sort of stay alive. But what happened was that 6 months later, there was just bureaucratic snafu after snafu, and they weren't getting the money. And it's only now, like in mid-July, that the spigot is finally on and that your average like rock club in downtown is like finally getting the money that Congress wanted them to get in December.
And to be frank, there have been other issues. You know, you wrote about certain people being mislabeled as dead, certain owners being mislabeled as dead. And they're not, obviously they're not dead. And also, I don't want to like downplay the complexity and scale of an operation like this. Like, obviously there's going to be a few things that go wrong, but it does seem that from the overall timing to the ineffectiveness of the rollout, this has been a particularly challenging stretch.
It's been disastrous. And for months now, I've been in like regular communication with venues all around the country that are all sort of saying like, you know, we're barely holding on here. When this law passed, we got this promise that like something was going to happen in the near future. And, you know, we don't know how much longer we can survive. So it's been really tough for them. And the ironic thing is that many of them are now finally getting that money only at the time that they're opening. And they still need the money because they have lots of debts. They may have repairs and other things to do. But this money was intended to get them over the hump to the point where they could have those shows rather than to give them nothing for all of that time and then deliver to them a bunch of money just at the point when they're finally able to sell tickets. So they need that money. They're going to use it. They're going to put it to good use. And hopefully it'll be enough for them to cover their debts and their obligations. But for most of this year, I think any smaller venue that you can think of has really been watching the clock and going like, I don't know if we're going to make it. And that's a problem for everybody. That's a problem for artists because, you know, if venues can't make it, they've got nowhere to play.
Let's pause for a quick break. We'll be right back with Ben.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones.
And I'm Mia Lee, and we are the editors of Modern Love at the New York Times and co-hosts of the Modern Love podcast.
We read love stories for a living.
And by love stories, we mean essays written by real people about all forms of human connection.
We're talking about everything from first dates to funerals, from sibling rivalries to new love at 85.
On our show, we're going to bring those stories to life. We'll hear from the writers and also from the people who are written about.
Relationships are the most important things in our lives. And the people that tell us their stories are just so brave, like way braver than than I think I am most of the time.
Yeah. They're so honest and so vulnerable. And listening to the stories, I feel like you absorb so much wisdom and you get a sense that you're not alone.
You can follow Modern Love wherever you get your podcasts, so you'll never miss an episode.
We hope you'll join us. New episodes are out every Wednesday.
We're back. Ben, did you see that piece in Billboard about tour bus drivers not returning to the road?
Yeah.
I'm sure there are many, many wrinkles in the return of live. That was one I hadn't given any thought to. The idea that the people who for decades perhaps have made their money spending 3 or 4 weeks at a time on the road, driving famous people around the country from tour date to tour date, or driving their sets around the country from tour date to tour date, after 12 months at home saying, I don't need to do that anymore. I'll stay local.
The labor market of touring music is a big one and a pretty diffuse one, because there's the drivers, but then there's also like the people who do lighting, the crew with the band. There are technical people that may be hired for certain shows. And I actually have had conversations with some of those people at different points over the last year and a half. And, you know, one thing I started to hear more recently was those people who could find other work during the pandemic, like, for example, people who do lighting and sound and are on more technical aspects of it, a lot of them went into like TV and live streaming. And a lot of them said, like, I don't really need to go back to touring and not seeing my family for 6 months at a time. This is a more stable gig. Some of that work may even be unionized in other sectors. So I think it's going to be a little bit of a problem. I think that ultimately, like, the lure of pay will bring a lot of workers back and it'll happen, but it may mean that there will just be problems and maybe a tour here or there will get postponed because of the bottleneck.
So you've spoken to folks who do work like that, or who are seeking people who do work like that, who are already mindful of the fact that there is going to be a crush, a labor crush at some point.
Oh, yeah. There's going to be a crush at every level. There's going to be that labor crush. There's going to be just the bottleneck of tours playing in arenas and in theaters this fall and next year, where there's only so many truck drivers. There's only so many dates available on the calendar. There's going to be competition for those. People who had a tour booked for 2020 bumped it to 2021. Most of them have bumped that to 2022. And then when the arena is looking at their calendar and they're saying, who have we got for April 5th, 2022? We actually have 5 holds on this date. Only one of them is actually going to get it. So those other ones have to go somewhere else. They kick it to 2023. So we're already looking at this huge backlog of events that have already been postponed once or twice. The ticket holders who, you know, gave their money a year or two ago and are still waiting, like, they might not actually see that show until like close to the next presidential election.
Here we are, July 2021. You're starting to see one-off shows happen. Like, if you go on, you know, Songkick or Oh My Rockness any given night, you see a few shows happening here in the city and everywhere else. Touring, though, as a big picture concern, we're not really seeing coming back till August, September, October. Can you explain the calculations that have been made or were being made as these things have started to ramp up? When did the touring companies, when did the booking agents accept that things were actually going to come back? Was it the announcement of a vaccine? Was it a certain percent threshold of vaccination? When did people start to say, all right, we got to get back on the road?
At some point in the spring, I want to say April or so, is when things started to really get booked. There was just a realization and I think a very strong desire to move forward. And if you remember, like, the first few months of the vaccine availability, progress was great. It was a relatively quick thing to get to the first 40 to 50% of the population that got the vaccine. But the problem that we've been having for the last couple months is it's really hard to get that last 40 to 50% vaccinated. That's really slowed down. But you're right about August, September, and the fall being more when we're seeing like big tours happen and arenas and really big venues like that starting to get their calendars filled up. But you're forgetting that there has been some activity with festivals.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And that is touring. And that's, I think that's sort of the first phase that we've seen where, you know, I think all of the players in the business looked at it and saw, okay, this is outdoor events. They're somewhat scalable in that we can start with a small crowd and then maybe sell more tickets if it's looking better. Artists can go to the event and then go home. They don't necessarily have to be on the road for weeks and weeks, at least at first. And so I think that was viewed as a way to wade into the water, see how it goes. And when they started to release tickets, they sold out fast. So we're going to see that. Rolling Loud, Lollapalooza, a bunch of others. We're already seeing that stuff starting to happen very, very soon.
So Rolling Loud in Miami is July 23rd to the 25th. Maybe see y'all there. Lollapalooza is the following weekend, the 29th to the 1st. Maybe see y'all there.
So that's happening.
Yes.
Like April, May was when people started to announce fall tours. I think there was a calculation that the summer will be a time to sort of test it out. Some festivals, things like amphitheaters. You know, right now, if you go to your local arena's calendar, you're not going to see a lot listed for July and August. But if you look at the calendar for your local outdoor amphitheater, you're actually going to see quite a bit there. I don't know if it's quite as full as it was in a typical summer 2 years ago, but there's a surprising amount there. We're seeing that happen. And then I think come fall, we're going to see more famous artists taking six tractor trailers on tour in, you know, 30 dates around the country, that kind of thing. That like touring as we know it, well, I think really start to return in the fall. I think people are going to want to get a lot of stuff in before winter comes. And then the question is, what happens in the winter? Will there be another outbreak? Will these variants slow everything down?
So when I went to the Foo Fighters show, you had to present proof of vaccination, quote unquote, proof. Quote unquote proof of quote unquote vaccination. What that meant in reality was as we were streaming in under that overhang coming off 7th Avenue into the garden, there was a rather hapless looking set of guards who were looking at people's phones as they kind of got to that place where you can go up that set of stairs towards where metal detectors are. They were just guards being like, looking at your phone. And if you showed something that looked like it was the New York State Excelsior pass, that was it. There wasn't any scanning. There wasn't any verifying. There wasn't anything to compare the name on that to the name on your driver's license. It was a free for all. I have been to a couple shows since then, not a single requirement about vaccination for any of the other shows that I have been to. What do you think this summer is going to look like in terms of COVID and how that's actually affecting touring, not just the lip service, but how is it actually affecting the live experience?
That's been one of the weirder variables in this, because even just a few weeks ago, I would have told you that there's going to be real strict controls and there's going to be, you know, the bouncer is going to check your ID and then he's going to check your Excelsior pass and say, get out of here, pal. You know, like all of the indications, including from the government, was that things were going to be kept tight. But gradually that has kind of flown out the window. You know, when I talk to venues, I want to say even just 3-4 weeks ago, there was a lot of confusion about, you know, we're raring to go. The vaccine stuff is great. We want to have shows. Yeah, it's going to take a little while to get the best bands in here, but like, we feel like we're ready to open the doors. Yet there was, you know, a foot on the brake because it was just tricky to navigate all these regulations from the government. Some of the rules changed unexpectedly, right? That was happening. But the latest thing, at least in New York State, venues under 5,000 capacity don't have to observe any regulations. They don't need to check vaccination status. They don't need to separate the crowds between vaccinated and unvaccinated. They don't even need to have masks. So for any venue smaller than, say, a Radio City kind of a level, it's just going to be business as usual. And it does concern me that, like you were saying about Madison Square Garden, I think it's a burden on those venues to do it, first of all. How are they really going to check 20,000 people's phones and make sure you're really John Caramonica and that's not a fake app or whatever? Like, that's just going to be difficult and expensive, and there's going to be some drunk guy in the back of the line heckling you. What's most likely is that, like, they're going to kind of do it, but then they're just going to wave people in is what probably is going to happen there. And it concerns me that is what's happening, that, like, the inertia is the thing that's going to drive it most of all.
Even as recently as a month ago or 2 months ago, the psychological barrier to returning to these spaces was going to be very high, and that people were going to be needing some reassurances, right? But I also think that the accreted time that people have spent, in essence, quarantining or inching back to real life, combined with, at least among vaccinated people, relatively high trust in the vaccine and what it does, you add those things together, and I think people are just like, yes, I am desperate to be in a club with people with no masks on. And I think whatever psychological barriers I was expecting to see in people or hear from other people, even 2 months ago, based on the shows I've been to in the last few weeks, I'm not catching like an iota of it. And for me, after the Foo Fighters show, which is the first real show that I went to after that, I've just been kind of thinking, well, okay, I trust that the vaccine's working, and I trust most people are going to be vaccinated at the shows I'm going to, even though someone I follow on Twitter, someone who works at the paper, actually just tested positive for COVID despite being vaccinated.
Whoa.
Yeah. So yikes. There are breakthrough cases, you know. He seems to be fine from a health perspective, but it's worth understanding that that's still a real thing. Did I just guarantee that you're going to stay home for another 6 months?
I don't think our bosses will allow me to do that, but that worries me for the business that we're covering, and for just us as a city and us as a country, is that what you're saying is that basically, like, people's pent up desire and frustration for all the red tape is what's going to make the decision. And that's not the best thing for public health.
I totally agree. And I'm a person, I'm down for the red tape. You know, like, I'm very excited. I stayed extremely inside for all those months for the year. But I will say, like, there have been a couple of weekends in New York, especially, and I'm thinking like May into June, probably Memorial Day and the one after, where you just were outside or at events or on a rooftop somewhere, and you're like, oh, you get a little bit of that taste of normalcy, a little bit of that joie de vivre. And it's, man, it's hard to go back. It's hard to go back. And I'm a very, very sober person, personality wise and in real life, but it's hard to go back. Also, as I've been traveling to other cities, I've been down south a couple times in the last month, and it's like COVID didn't happen, you know? I was like going somewhere and I was fumbling to put on a mask outside, and the person who was at the door just kind of like laughed at me. And he was like, come on, man, you don't got to do that down here. And I was like, oh, you know, it's very, very hard to realign what I've been feeling anxiety wise with the emerging realities around the country.
Sadly, I think that what that means is we're just going to sort of wait, and we're going to see what it looks like in 6 months. And then maybe we'll say, oops, maybe that wasn't the right way to do it. That's my worry.
So does that mean that you yourself will not go to shows?
No, I will. I'm excited to. And I feel like it's the beat now, right? Like, that is what is happening. Like, that I need to see these. I need to be at these places and see what's happening. So, like, I expect to do plenty of it. I'd like to say I'm going to be, you know, a good little Boy Scout and wear my mask all the time and wash my hands and all that. I don't know. We'll see.
I guess what it comes down to is catch Ben Cesario outside this summer, catch me outside this summer, presumably catch Karen Gans and Joe Coscarelli outside this summer, and hopefully we'll catch y'all outside this summer, although I do wish safe concert going for everybody. Ben, I sort of suspect we might be doing this again in 6 months to assess how the rollout actually went.
I hope it's good news. I hope we can talk about all the great shows we've been to and how everything is looking great.
Yeah, all the great shows and also the Foo Fighters. Hi, Karen. Ben, thanks for calling. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com, especially if you, and do this on the Facebook group too, if you are going out to shows or you live somewhere in the country where shows have been low-key popping off for the last few months, I'd be really interested to hear about it. Maybe we'll even do an episode on that later in the fall. Let me know, popcastnytimes.com. Subscribe to Popcast anywhere you get your audio. That's Apple, that's Spotify, that's Stitcher, etc. Our producer, Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. Ben, who's an artist you would like to see that you want to see this fall? Let's play an optimistic song to go out. Who are you itching to see?
This is going to sound crazy, but I want to see Ween really, really bad.
For the first time ever on Popcast, a Ween song. Ben, what Ween song should we play that would convince me that seeing Ween is a good idea?
Well, I want to hear Push the Little Daisies, but I don't think it's going to convince you.
Deep sigh. Here's Ween, Push the Little Daisies. We're out.